It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP at 90.3 FM Seattle. And we are joined once again by none other than Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors of Eat the State, amongst many, many other talents that 30 minutes isn't enough to cover for both of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you both doing?
Good.
It's a warm, sunny summer day.
Have all my fingers.
Yeah, you were
both your eyes.
You were thinking maybe you might wake up this morning and be missing one or two. Or
yeah. Kapow.
Yeah. Okay, so it isn't like you have a pretty aggressive cookie jar where you're at.
No.
Let's talking about the fourth. Gosh, not only do we have all our fingers, but. All the buildings and bridges seem to be intact, too.
Yeah, funny thing. We kept getting all these public warnings about big explosions that might happen on the 4th, and then, sure enough, they were happening right outside my window. Darndest thing. My dogs didn't appreciate it at all. But it was really kind of ridiculous, the spectacle that we've been treated to for the last week of all of these warnings and repeated warnings. And locally, it really started about a week and a half ago when our King County sheriff, a man who is never one to run away from a camera or a microphone, Dave Reichert, came out of a secret closed session of the King County Council saying that what's going on in there is the local head of the FBI is telling county council members that Seattle is almost certainly going to be struck by terrorists from Al-Qaeda or whomever, who are going to come all the way from their cave in Saudi Arabia, or maybe their mansion in Saudi Arabia or someplace.
Their cave in Western Pakistan.
Yeah, whatever. to wreak havoc upon our homelands or our nicely manicured lawns in the suburbs or whatever. And by the way, budget considerations are coming up, and wouldn't it be nice to give us a few new toys and some extra personnel for the holidays? It really is just about that brazen that what's being talked about with a lot of these public warnings are a combination of butt covering that in a minuscule chance that anything actually does happen, that nobody wants to be blamed for it or said we weren't paying attention, I think equally or more likely that law enforcement wants more personnel, they want more toys, they want more money, and they want more power, and they want less accountability for what they want to do. And so you have spectacles like down in Clark County in Vancouver, the fairgrounds where they have their big public 4th of July fireworks every year. This year they fenced the area off and we're searching everybody coming inside. You know, if I'm coming from that cave in Pakistan, I'm going to make a beeline for Clark County, Washington on the 4th of July. When the movie Independence Day came out, the aliens came from 26,000 light years away and they chose the 4th of July. And hey, these guys are aliens too. So, you know, they probably think alike. So it really is, you know, preposterous. If there is a terrorist attack in this country, and you know, we have no evidence that any has been interrupted over the last 9 months. I mean, we had this spectacle last month of Jose Padilla, a man against whom there's virtually no evidence at all. They were holding him for 40 days. They plan to hold him for the rest of his natural life if they can get away with it without ever exposing him to the light of day, let alone charges or a trial. So the only way we ever would have found out that they had this guy is if they had made the public announcement, which they did very carefully, as noisily as possible. And so you know perfectly well that...
And as politically as possible.
As politically as possible. And so you know that if there had been a more credible plot, more credible threat, that they would have trumpeted that too, because they're trumpeting all of these things in support of a political agenda. And, you know, that political agenda has to do with keeping people scared and keeping people scared so they can have more power and more authority and more money. It really is useful to remind ourselves of those sorts of things when we hear about this hysteria on the 4th of July, because we're going to hear about it on every holiday. We're going to hear about it on every anniversary. We're going to hear about it every time budget considerations come up. I mean, you know, how long does this have to go on before it no longer becomes a rationale for public policy? Particularly when there's no evidence to support it.
And asking, again, getting back to Reichert and the FBI agent at the King County Council, asking for more money where already the King County budget is slated at, I believe, about 66% going to law enforcement and criminal related issues.
Yeah, justice mm-hmm. system, the jails, the prisons, and law enforcement agencies. It's an enormous money suck. Both the prison system and our law enforcement agencies are by far the largest drain on our public resources. And the reason that is the case is for the last 20 years, all of these other areas of public spending, particularly social safety nets and social programs, have been steadily eroded, you know, spending less and less money, particularly comparable to inflation and the dollar, on these programs, even when, as in the case of healthcare, the costs have been rising exponentially. And at the same time, these areas of the budget have been sacrosanct. In fact, they've been going up. And when that happens year after year for a couple of decades, you're going to wind up with those kind of percentages. That two-thirds of the money is going to this,
mm-hmm. And you're gonna see articles in the newspaper about how we need to spend more, and they don't compare the spending in the last 5 years to prior years. They compare it to what the police departments have been asking for.
Yeah.
So they've been asking for this huge amount, and they've been getting like 9/10 of it.
Which oddly enough, that's what every department and every bureaucracy does, is they inflate their budgetary requests.
They ask for everything they want.
So they ask for more than they want, hoping mm-hmm. that the honorable compromise will get them what they actually want.
What they actually need.
Or what they think they need. So it really is a very, very political process. And the way it's being driven at this point is to keep people scared. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very politicized at this point. And it has very little to do with actual terrorism and the actual threat, which really is out there. But it's being manipulated for very different ends.
Yeah, and occasionally if you look really hard and you read a lot, you see the reports, like the FBI report, that they said, oh, well, we were fairly sure that any terrorist attack that was going to happen around this time was going to be overseas.
Yeah, because particularly in the United States, these kind of attacks are going to come on dates that are significant to the terrorists. They're not going to come on dates that are significant to us.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to come on dates when we're particularly looking for it either.
And we have to remember, too, that overseas terrorist attacks have been a threat for the last 100 years.
Yeah, they're nothing new. The only thing that was new about September 11th was that it happened on U.S. soil and that we paid attention to it.
And the scale of it.
Yeah.
Well, depending on your viewpoint, there was a terrorist attack earlier this week in Afghanistan. There was a wedding party, and apparently the U.S. decided to drop its presence from attack.
Before we leave U.S. soil, I thought where you were going with that was the shooting yesterday at the LL terminal in Los Angeles, and I just mm-hmm. wanted to parenthetically mention to that that the original accounts of that were coming out initially, eyewitnesses were saying that the guy was down and the guy was disarmed on the floor, and the security guard from LL came over and stood over him and basically shot him point blank
just
and killed him. Executed him. And funny thing that in the newspaper this morning, that account has been transmogrified, as Calvin would say, into he was shot in a struggle, in a gunfight. This guy was executed basically mm-hmm. in broad daylight.
And I think
at what point was that? Did that become legal in this country?
Right. And I think the early accounts said that he was also arguing with someone at the terminal.
Although they were now saying that there was no evidence that that happened, and that there is evidence that he planned this ahead of time. Whether that's true or not is anybody's guess. But what is certainly true is that he was executed.
Well, one would hope with that situation that at least there were plenty of witnesses that'll be able to give their accounts. So,
yeah, but whether those accounts are published.
Yeah. Well, that's where the alternative media comes in.
Yep.
So,
and here we are.
Afghanistan, making the papers this week as if it didn't exist anymore.
Yes, no, I think in this case we really see how the Pentagon spins things, because when it first happened, we heard a few people were killed.
Whichever it we're talking about. There's several different
it's. We're talking about the latest bombs and strafing of civilian villages in southeastern Afghanistan. When it first happened, we heard, a few dead, and a bomb went astray, a precision-guided bomb.
And it might not even be, it was our bomb went astray, but it might not even been our bomb. It might have been the anti-artillery
fire.
I'm getting to that.
That a bomb went astray. First we hear that a precision-guided bomb went astray, and then the body count starts going up. And a guy comes forward and says, no, I was the bomb spotter, and that bomb didn't hit any villages. It hit the ground. And then we hear, it was an AC-130 gunship shot up an area around Mullah Muhammad Omar's home village, so that makes it okay. And there was an anti-aircraft fire. And then the body count keeps going up.
Yeah,
the body count keeps going up. And then we hear, well, there was a plane there. You know, the Pentagon says, oh, yeah, there was a plane there. There was an AC-130 gunship. They might have shot some villagers by mistake. You know, they were really going for the anti-aircraft weapon, right? And then finally, the U.S. says, well, we're going to send investigators over there. And the U.S. investigators throw up their hands and say, well, we can't find any bodies, so nobody was shot or bombed.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, we have reporters over there saying, well, you know, we not only found the bodies, we found the graves and the family members, and we even found out the bombed out and bullet-strafed houses with relative ease, you know, plus, and by the way,
Of course, they left Kabul.
Right, exactly, they were in Kabul. And by the way, you know, there were not even any fragments of any anti-aircraft weapons laying around. So what gives? And of course today I open the newspaper and I see Bush apologizing to Hamid Karzai. But the real problem with this is there was no questioning by the US media, you know, and no explanations from the Pentagon as to why our Afghan allies in the Karzai government would lie. Why would they say there were six villages that were strafed? You know, why would they say that there were at least 200 people wounded and over 40 killed, possibly over 50 killed?
Yeah, these were not sort of like local chieftains who had a beef because they hadn't gotten paid off by the soldiers or whatever. These were the highest levels of our allies' government, a government that basically we installed a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. And so there was no question of why would they lie? Why would they make up a story? And finally, I want to just say, you know, if the U.S. military keeps killing all the supporters of the current Afghan government, as these people were in southeastern Afghanistan, who's going to be left? We're going to be left with the jihadis, with the people who supported the Taliban, and with the relatives and friends of people who have been killed by U.S. airplanes.
And we're also going to be left with an awful lot of people in Afghanistan saying, you know, one of the reasons why we were willing to give this guy Karzai a chance and we were willing to give the Americans a chance, even though they came from halfway around the world and invaded our country, is because we wanted the fighting to stop. Well, the fighting's not stopping. The Americans are still killing us. So what gives? And you wind up going back to the very real threat of civil war that is, you know, just hanging in the background with all these different warlords who are basically being kept at bay, not because anybody is disarmed, not even because anybody is among these guys with all the weapons is committed to keeping the peace, but because everybody's getting paid off. But, you know, if they feel like it's in their interest to go back to picking up guns and fighting again, they will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of people in that part of Afghanistan among the Pashtun tribes who are unhappy with Karzai because his government is full of members of other ethnic groups in key positions, and there are very few Pashtuns, and especially very few people from inside Afghanistan.
Yeah, the Pashtuns who are there are all people
who spent their formative
periods of their lives hanging out in the Ivy League, basically.
Yeah, in California or at Johns Hopkins University and places like that, or working for the World Bank. So there's a lot of dissatisfaction right now with the Karzai government, even among its supporters in southeastern Afghanistan.
So Pashtuns with business suits?
Basically, yeah.
Basically. And at this point, I'm sure some of the people who've been living in Afghanistan all through the civil wars and all through the Taliban are thinking, these guys are not real, don't really represent us because they don't know what we've been through.
Yeah, and these guys turned and tucked tail and ran when the troubles came, and we stayed and stuck it through and tried to steer our country through the troubled times. These guys didn't. How dare they come in and now tell us what to do?
And keep the U.S. here. as they have been doing, mm-hmm. and allow the U.S. airplanes to target villages and kill civilians.
Yeah, and let's not forget that all of this started with al-Qaeda attacks against the United States, one of the primary stated motivations of which was that the U.S. went into Saudi Arabia and stayed there after the Gulf War. And we promised we would leave, and we didn't leave, and in fact kept expanding our presence. And funny thing, the natives got resentful. So mm-hmm. you know, we're not learning any of those lessons at all. In fact, we don't even seem to be interested in acknowledging those lessons.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on.
All right. Well, I suspect that both of you are with great anticipation, gleefully waiting for the coming Bush speech about corporate accountability. I know I am.
He's come out foursquare against it, I take it.
Are you sure?
He wants to be accountable to the corporations. He believes in that. That's a good governing principle.
He's been so
that's
far.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it was a shock to me anyway when Bush started talking about how I want to bring those criminals to justice and see them punished. And he was talking about WorldCom executives.
I thought it was a sitcom. I thought it was Saturday Night Live parody or something.
I thought, you know, boy, those Bush speechwriters, they're having a ball, aren't they?
or somebody was messing with his teleprompter or something.
Right, yeah. Right. And the reason I thought that is because Bush has been in charge of some pretty shifty business enterprises in his life, including being on the board of Harkin Energy Corp. Now, the media's been...
And let's not even start about Dick Cheney and Halliburton.
Right, exactly. And the media's been focusing on his insider trading, which is old news. The insider trading involves selling stock in Harkin Energy Corp just a couple weeks before they announced a loss, which drove the stock price down from $4 to $1. And so there's always been a suspicion, and he didn't, I guess, file some forms with the SEC on time. And so there's always been some suspicion that there was some insider trading going on. I think there's no question that there was. But more importantly, they're not focusing on the fact that Bush himself did what many of these WorldCom executives and Enron executives did. He sat on the board, and not only did he sit on the board of Harkin Energy Corp, he sat on the audit committee, which was responsible for really delving into the financial statements and looking at how things were being reported on the balance sheet. He sat on the audit committee. And he sat on an audit committee that did not stop the company from improperly booking income. Particularly a $12 million sale of a portion of the business to employees of Harkin. That was not true income, but it was booked as income, and Bush did nothing about that. So really, he's in a position himself, the same position as these members, as these WorldCom executives, Scott Sullivan and Bernard Ebbers and Kenneth Lay and Fastow and all those right. all those guys at Enron.
Although in his defense, there's really not much evidence that Bush can read, let alone that he can read a balance sheet. So,
or that understands how to add or anything.
Yeah, so I mean, he was on that audit committee basically because of his family name. And many of the same reasons that a lot of people get appointed to the boards of companies, medium-sized and big companies, is because they're on the boards of other companies or because of their connections. It's because of who they know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no real oversight that comes with that position. On paper, it's supposed to exercise oversight. But in fact, most of how large corporations in this country are run these days, there is no meaningful oversight from the institutions that are supposed to provide
it. There's one guy, the CFO, the chief financial officer, and he does all of this work, massaging the books, and then he presents it to the board, and the board sits around and, you know, they're having their drinks and they're talking and laughing and chatting, and where are you going to go on vacation?
And the CFO is being paid in stock options too.
Right, and they glance at the financial sheets and they go, it looks good, as long as it's turning a profit, that's great, and then they adjourn the meeting. But what's even more fishy about this whole situation is that Bush came up under investigation by the SEC during his daddy's time in office. And the SEC didn't exactly clear him, but they certainly didn't slap any penalties on him. So I think there's a question there of, was there some pressure, because this was the president's son, that the SEC did it in a way where they said they thought he was guilty, but they really weren't going to punish him. Now that's ridiculous. Okay, I mean that's ridiculous. It's not only telling you that the SEC has no power over someone like George Bush's son, but it's also saying that as an enforcement arm, as a regulatory arm, the SEC doesn't count for very darn much.
And bear in mind that was 10 years ago. The SEC mm-hmm. wields considerably less enforcement power now than it did then.
Has fewer employees and a smaller budget now.
Yeah, and has gone through an era over the last decade where they were encouraged, if not commanded, to look the other way.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, I know the media's covered a little bit, but can we anticipate SEC getting its budget notched up a bit?
No, in fact, that's one of the things that's not being talked about in Congress is anything that would... I mean, they're talking about revising accounting rules and talking about maybe making some changes in how stock options are awarded to executives or whether they should be awarded to executives at all. But there's been no discussion of beefing up any enforcement or any way of looking at these corporate balance sheets and ensuring that they're accurate information. There's been no discussion of bringing more money to the SEC or anything, or even of... I mean, there's been a little discussion of changing the way financial accounting is overseen, but that hasn't gone anywhere.
Yeah, the broad picture of what Congress is looking at doing, which basically tells you what you need to know about how committed these guys are to meaningful reform, is that the mantra throughout much of the last decade has been, well, corporations are capable of policing themselves. Mm-hmm. And so what we're getting from Congress now is, well, that went terribly awry. Corporations, in fact, do horrible things when they're left to police themselves. So we're going to change the laws by which corporations police themselves.
To make sure they adhere to a few little things we think can be tweaked, but everything else.
Or that when they don't adhere to the laws, it's different, more stringent laws that they're not adhering to.
Yeah, we punish them a little more severely when the stock price goes down. which of course is like an incentive to keep the stock price up, even if you're committing fraud, right?
Yep.
All right, let's move along. New York District Court ruling this week that... Job you wanted to
very interesting ruling coming out of a district federal court in New York. A judge named Jed Rakoff came out with a ruling basically that the death penalty was unconstitutional, and the debate over the death penalty changes with the changing times. It goes back and forth over the decades as to whether it basically comes down to a community standards kind of ruling, and basically that community standard is whether the death penalty does in fact constitute cruel and unusual punishment. Now, if you look up the definition of cruel in the dictionary, it says things like without leniency and, you know, various other things that it's pretty hard to argue that capital punishment in any form adds up to being cruel, and it's kind of usual at this point, but it's definitely cruel. The particular court ruling in New York, which is, you know, probably going to be appealed, and when it is, it will probably be overturned, but it's certainly sort of an indicator of the times and the ways in which courts are looking at this question, particularly in combination with some of the U.S. Supreme Court rulings recently. What Rakoff said in his decision was that the death penalty constitutes cruel and unusual punishment because there is an appreciable chance that people who are innocent will be executed, that the percentage of people who will be executed will not just be a random mistake here and there, that it will be an appreciable number of people. And for that reason, you know, that there is a good probable reason, there's a probable reason to believe that fairly sizable number of innocent people will be executed. There are a couple of reasons why this judge could come up with this particular ruling, one of which, of course, is DNA testing. Mm-hmm. There are something like 101 different prisoners now since the reinstitution of the death penalty in the mid-70s, most of them fairly recent cases where inmates on death row were exonerated of their crimes.
That's an astonishing number.
Yeah, it's an incredible number, particularly when you consider that most of the people in death row have not had their cases investigated in any meaningful kind of way. when Illinois instituted its moratorium a couple of years ago, saying we're not going to execute any more people until we take a closer look at how the death penalty is applied in our state, it was because half of the people on their death row had been exonerated. The reason half had been exonerated was not because Illinois had any particularly error-prone judicial system. It was because there's a class project at Northwestern University that every year takes death row penalty cases and goes and investigates them. Incredible because
some university students.
Yeah. So what you have is when people are taking a closer look at these cases, an incredible number of which are reliant on sole eyewitnesses, or they're reliant on snitches who are given reduced jail time or plea
rewarded
bargains.
Rewarded for pointing a finger.
Yeah, exactly. Rewarded for pointing a finger, that there's actually very little direct evidence in a lot of these cases. You wind up with a lot of people that are innocent. The other thing that is particularly contributing to this syndrome of innocent people on death row is that over the last 10 years, as part of the whole tough-on-crime approach, you've gotten fewer and fewer opportunities for people to appeal sentences, and particularly fewer opportunities for habeas corpus, for people to introduce exonerating evidence mm-hmm. after a jury reaches a verdict, let alone after a judge provides or a jury provides a sentence.
Part of all of our tough on crime
yeah.
and save money in the judicial part of the judicial system.
Yeah, we're going to streamline the penalty.
We're going to beef up police departments, but we're going to streamline the judicial part of the judicial
system. Yeah, exactly. We're going to streamline the process so all of these killers can't drag out their sentences by all of these endless appeals at which some of them might be able to prove that, in fact, they are innocent.
Perhaps half of the people on death
yeah.
row.
Yeah, and so what happens is you have death penalty advocates who say, yeah, you execute a certain percentage of innocent people, but that's an acceptable price to pay, that you're going to execute some innocent people, because the overall value to society is that it sends a message. And that message, of course, you know, there's no evidence that the death penalty actually prevents any kind of crime or prevents murder or anything like that. The message that it sends is that we killed the guy. We killed the scumbag. We killed the SOB. And, you know, the death penalty in this country basically is about vengeance. It's about feeling good that we killed the guy. And in order to provide the societal value of being able to feel good about these guys being killed, we're willing to kill some innocent people.
Right, and by the way, you know, life in prison is no cupcake either.
No, it's not. But so what?
If anything
was
going to be a deterrent, I think that would.
Right. So what the district court ruling in New York actually said this week was that the particular percentage of people that it is acceptable to kill, even though they are innocent, to kill, you know, with state funding in a very carefully premeditated spectacle. I mean, that is a crime that, to my way of thinking, is actually worse than the original crime, which may have occurred in the heat of the moment. I mean, this is premeditated. It's done with tax dollars. You know, it's glorified in our media. But at the same time, that the idea is that it's unconstitutional because more than a certain minimally acceptable number of innocent people are executed. It's not that any innocent people are executed, and that's a bad thing. It's that, you know, some more innocent people are being executed than we're comfortable with. If you were being a stickler for justice in our justice system, you might say something like, well, if an innocent person is executed, that's a bad thing. And we should try to be reforming the system so that no innocent people are executed. There was a hilarious line in the Washington Post article on this ruling, by the way, that says that, well, 101 people on death row have been exonerated. However, there's been no evidence that anybody who was actually executed was, in fact, innocent of their crime. Well, you know, that's because people stop investigating and courts stop listening to the cases when the guy is executed, because the case is kind of moot at that point. But, you know, people are actually mm-hmm. willing to make those kind of arguments to justify this system. Well, nobody's ever proven that, you know,
that we've executed.
Yeah, because nobody's ever bothered to prove it, because it would be pointless. The sad fact of the case is that nothing is going to reform the system short of abolition of the death penalty. So that while these different little piecemeal rulings are very welcome, the idea that you can not apply capital punishment to people who are mentally handicapped, or you have to have a jury making the decision rather than judges, or that we've exceeded the number of minimally acceptable number of innocent people. Nothing's going to reform that system short of the abolition of the death penalty, period. End of story. Like most other, all other Western democracies have done.
And that would come from what body?
It would, well, at this point, it's most likely to have to come from a judicial ruling somewhere, because we our profiles encourage that our state and federal legislative bodies certainly are not going to do that. There has been some lessening of public support for the death penalty in recent years, particularly, I think, because of the publicity around all of these innocent cases. But it's still relatively popular. It's still a majority of people in this country. And if you look at Western Europe, if you look at the history of the death penalty in other democracies where it has been abolished, it's almost always come from the courts or from legislative bodies. It's always been fairly popular among the public. Something like three-quarters of the British, in a poll that was taken at the time it was executed, still supported it. So it's going to have to come from the courts or the legislatures.
I'm assuming that was, at the time it was executed, was a joke.
Yes.
talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And one of you, tell us, what is Eat the State?
Eat the State is a little bi-weekly newspaper that we print every other week in Seattle. And you can find it in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, bars, various places around town. You can check us out on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And I think the phone number is 903-9461.
Very, very good. Right? You know, it's remarkable that Maria has such a remarkable memory for detail week after week and cannot come up with a phone number. That's great.
Yeah, well, you know.
And she's our numbers person, so.
Yeah.
That's what I got my cheat sheets here for.
All right. So we'll see you both next week. No, Job, you're out of town.
I'm out of town, but Maria will be back.
I'll be here.
Holding down the fort.
All right. Very good. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay.